I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour, we're delighted to have returned to the program, Larry Tai. Larry wrote a book that I just loved, one of my favorite books of last year. I'm terribly interested in the decade of the 60s and in the Kennedy family. His book, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Larry is a former Boston Globe reporter. He covered the Kennedy family for a number of years. And he's currently in Wisconsin working on a book on Senator Joseph McCarthy. And of course, there's a link between Bobby Kennedy and Senator McCarthy. Larry's going to be speaking tonight from 6:30 to 8 at the Pyle Center, UW-Madison. And I'll be talking about Bobby Kennedy, his great book, and also about McCarthy. Other books of Larry's include Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend, The Story of Negro Leagues Pitcher Satchel Paige, Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. We'll be welcoming phone calls. We're going to cover a lot of ground with Larry. He wrote some interesting pieces in Wisconsin papers about to win again, Democrats need someone like Bobby Kennedy. So we'll talk about that and Joe McCarthy and the key to Kennedy's broad appeal and if there's anybody around who can step up to the challenge of the Democrats winning again in 2018 and more during the course of the hour. And, of course, Senator Joe McCarthy. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hi, Larry. Thanks for joining us again. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, and you're going to have a big speech tonight. What are you talking about?
Talk a little bit about Bobby Kennedy and talk about his role with Joe McCarthy and talk a little bit about what I'm looking at in terms of a biography of Joe McCarthy.
Mm-hmm. Have you sensed, one of the things we always say about Wisconsin is, isn't it strange that here we have a state that elected Senator Joe McCarthy and Fighting Bob La Follette?
So I find it really interesting. The idea that the seat went from La Follette to Joe McCarthy to William Proxmire,
yes,
is an extraordinary sense either of your diversity or of your schizophrenia, but I think it's a really interesting take on Wisconsin.
Yeah, it sure is. Let's start with the Democrats, because you wrote a piece in one of the Wisconsin papers, I can't remember which one, as the Democrats start to look at the post-election wilderness, you say they need someone like Bobby Kennedy who could appeal to angry working-class whites who rallied to Trump and to Hillary Clinton's coalition of minorities and liberals. Who in the world might that be, Larry?
So that's a great question. The answer is, in part, that we have to look back in 1968 when Bobby Kennedy was running his quixotic and, I think, inspired campaign for president. He came with a credibility among white working-class voters, which was precisely the kind of credibility that would have let him appeal to Trump voters. He came in and also built a coalition with Hillary Clinton's liberals and minorities. And when we look today to who could build that same kind of coalition, and this will seem like a trite answer, but I would look to a guy who just announced his campaign for governor of Illinois, and I think is going to be the next governor of Illinois, and his name is Christopher Kennedy. He is Bobby's youngest son and an incredibly inspired guy who gets precisely what his father was talking about. And my guess is we will have a dozen Democrats out there like this who aren't on our radar screen now, who are coming in and realizing these new circumstances require a new and different and maybe Bobby Kennedy kind of candidate.
Mm. I think the last time we talked to you, you mentioned Joseph F. Kennedy III.
I did. And I think that that was because he was the only Kennedy on the horizon then. When I was out doing my tour on the Bobby Kennedy book, and I was speaking to a very large group of Irish Americans in Chicago, this guy who I mentioned a minute ago, Chris Kennedy, introduced me. And before he introduced me, I watched him work that room.
Oh.
And I have never seen anybody who wasn't named Kennedy, at least in my experience with Massachusetts politics, work a room like a Kennedy did and like Chris did. I think Chris Kennedy is somebody from the generation following Bobby. In the generation behind him, there's young Congressman Joe Kennedy from Massachusetts. There are also a whole lot of people whose name isn't Kennedy who are out there who I think are testing out these themes. And this is a new era, the Donald Trump era, and it will require a new kind of message. Yet I think just the kind of model that we need is one we can look back to in our history of half a century ago.
Hmm. You write in the book about, and you wrote in the recent article, of the way that Bobby Kennedy fashioned these really bold bipartisan solutions to problems. And if you would please tell the story of what he did and the plans for rebuilding Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn.
Sure. So if your listeners aren't aware, Bedford-Stuyvesant was the biggest ghetto in America and one of the poorest. And he went in there and he said, the only thing that's going to work here is if we throw out all of our blueprints and are willing to try anything. And what try anything meant was, on the one hand, appeal to corporate titans, to his pal who was the head of IBM, to the head of the biggest companies in the world who happened to be based in nearby Manhattan, and he said, you've got to come in and you've got to build plants and you've got to bring jobs to this 90% African-American community that needs jobs more than anything. But he also said to the community, we're not going to give control over your community to these business titans who are coming in. We're going to give you an unprecedented level of neighborhood control in deciding how programs are going to be fashioned in your community. So this is going to be a partnership with solutions from the far left, solutions from capitalism, anything that would work. And he did it, and it was working, and it became the basis, in many ways, the inspiration for the war on poverty. Lyndon Johnson partly took notice and partly hated Bobby Kennedy enough that anything that Bobby Kennedy looked like he was doing that might succeed, Johnson wanted to outdo him. So it was a perfect solution. He could try it as a small experiment, and he could get the president to take him seriously because the president didn't like him.
Mm-hmm. And Bobby Kennedy had this, and it seemed to be very real, and you've covered the family for a long time and wrote a book about Bobby, seemed to be quite genuine. His real concern about hunger in America, about poverty in America, something that literally kept him awake at night.
Yes, so can I tell a brief story
of
about
course.
The hunger in America?
Please.
So Bobby Kennedy goes along with a bunch of other senators and hears at a hearing in Washington, D.C., a Senate hearing, he hears a woman named Marion Wright, who now is known as Marion Wright Edelman, a young African-American lawyer from Mississippi, tells these senators, people are starving in Mississippi, and people in the Senate don't believe her. Nobody in America could be starving. So the senators decide they're going to pack up and go to Mississippi and hold a hearing there, and Bobby goes with them. And all the senators actually hear much more graphic illustration of the fact that there really was hunger in America. There were people who couldn't afford the couple dollars it took as a co-payment on food stamps, and they were literally starving. And all but two of those senators pack up after the hearing and go back to a weekend in their comfortable surroundings in Washington. And Bobby Kennedy says, you've told us about it twice. I want to see it. So Margaret Edelman, Margaret Wright, takes him on a tour of the Mississippi Delta, which on the one hand was the breadbasket of America, and on the other hand was one of the poorest places in America. And Bobby Kennedy, when he thinks nobody is watching, he goes into one shack of sharecropper farmers, African-American family, five kids, very poor, a clothesline strung across the living room. And he goes into the kitchen. He sees a toddler sitting on the floor playing with his food, stirring it around and around, this rice concoction. Bobby, in his business suit, gets down on the floor with this toddler, and for the next 5 minutes, you could see two things happening. One is a U.S. senator suddenly becoming a human being and trying to make some physical connection with a toddler. Flies flying overhead, ultimate poverty. The other thing you saw, if you look closely enough, was tears streaming down that senator's face. And he left that scene in Mississippi. He went home to his family estate in called Hickory Hill in McLean, Virginia, and he gave his children a lecture on how they had a responsibility to do something to make a difference in America. And his children have shown up at several of my book talks, and they can recite 60 years later, word for word, what Bobby Kennedy said that Sunday afternoon to them. This is a guy who really was kept up at night and the kind of politician that we don't often see. The word that I most associate with him is the word authentic. And that's not a word we generally use with our politicians today.
Yeah, that's quite a story. So you go from writing this inspirational book about a man who had a very tragic end, and it's really a story of how he went from pretty conservative guy and how he grew and grew and became this incredibly tender-hearted but tough man, to now writing a book about Senator Joe McCarthy, and their paths, of course, crossed early on in Bobby's career. Why? Why are you doing a book about McCarthy now?
Three reasons. Short version is, one reason was because when I was doing the Bobby Kennedy book and trying to understand Bobby Kennedy's relationship with his first boss, Joe McCarthy, I heard stories about him that I'd never heard before from people like Ethel Kennedy, who had never told them before. And she said to much of America, Joe McCarthy might have looked like a monster, but to the Kennedy family, he was the guy who came and played with their toddler, Kathleen, who was charming, who was not the figure that we were seeing in public. So that intrigued me, the sense that maybe there was another side to this guy. A second thing is that in recent years, and never fully plumbed, is a whole set of records. Your listeners are familiar with the famous McCarthy hearings, the Army McCarthy hearings, and the other ones that were held with great public fanfare. But in fact, that was only one-third of the hearings that he held. The other two-thirds were in private session behind closed doors, embargoed for 50 years.
Oh.
And those are now public, and I've been reading the 10,000 pages of transcripts.
Oh, my gosh.
And those show a different side of Joe McCarthy. And the third reason is what happened last November. The election put into the White House a guy who, in lots of ways, mimics Joe McCarthy. To his fans, to McCarthy's fans and Donald Trump's fans, that's a positive association, maybe. To other people, it suggests a demagogic strain. But to me, I think to understand who Donald Trump is, one way to do that is to go back and understand who John McCarthy is. Mm-hmm. And as you know, and as your listeners know, the protege of Joe McCarthy, yes, this guy named Roy Cohn, was a tutor at his old age of a young Donald Trump.
Yes. So what have you gleaned from those 10,000 pages that we haven't seen before? I know you're just going through them, but what are you learning?
So I'm learning that the Joe McCarthy behind closed doors was a different character in lots of ways from the one that we saw in public. And some of the ways are that there were no constraints. When you were doing hearings that you thought were never going to be made public, the question of rights of defendants, the question of the kinds of questions you would ask, there were no holds barred. And this is just a very different, this was not playing to any spotlight because there was no spotlight. And the idea that these things have been sitting there for all that time and are finally there in the light of day, just to me as an old journalist, was irresistible.
Mm-hmm. And tell us again about the connection between Bobby Kennedy and Joe McCarthy, his first boss. Kennedy was enthusiastic at first but grew quite disillusioned.
Yes. So Kennedy was very enthusiastic. He felt that Joe McCarthy was the only guy in America who was standing up and exposing the communist threat, not just in terms of what was going on in the Soviet Union, but what was going on in places like the State Department. And the single best set of hearings that Joe McCarthy ever held were the ones that were staffed by Bobby Kennedy, looking at the fact that our allies were trading with our enemies while we were fighting the Koreans, the Communist Koreans, and the Red Chinese during the Korean War. And Bobby Kennedy was morally outraged. He ran a very reasonable set of hearings that were the only hearings that McCarthy ever held that got full bipartisan support. So he started out as a big McCarthy believer. He began over time to question especially Roy Cohn's methods. And as he became more politically disillusioned and left McCarthy's staff, he never lost the sense of loyalty to McCarthy as a friend. And so even though his brother Jack told him not to go to Joe McCarthy's funeral in Appleton in 1957, Bobby showed up there.
Yeah, tell us that story. That's a great story. He showed up there, but he didn't want anybody to see that he was there, did he?
Right. So what he did was he waited. He showed up. He flew into Green Bay in a plane that included 17 U.S. senators, 7 congressmen, and a bunch of other dignitaries. They all jump off the plane, they pile into their limousines, and they go to the funeral in nearby Appleton. Bobby waits till everybody is gone. He bums a ride to the funeral with a reporter who he swears to secrecy, not saying that he was there. He goes up and watches the funeral from the choir loft and the graveside service from just far enough away that he's convinced nobody will see him. And then he begs all the journalists who recognize him not to include him in their stories, and they don't. And luckily for me, 50 years later, when I come along to tell the story, one of those reporters who wanted to purge his soul of having kept this secret all these years was willing to spill the beans.
That's great. And as you travel around the state, are there people still around who remember Senator McCarthy? Do people have opinions about him? I know you're working on your book now.
They do, and I would love to hear opinions from more people, but as just one example, on Friday night in Appleton, I had my first experience with a Wisconsin fish fry.
All right.
And my hostess at the Yacht Club of Appleton was a 97-year-old woman named Cody Split, who back in the 1940s was a young Republican and helped shuttle Joe McCarthy around in his first Senate campaign. And I found a surprising number of people who were around as journalists, around as Democratic or Republican activists, who actually have firsthand stories about Joe McCarthy.
Mm. We're going to welcome phone calls. Maybe you'll get some of those calls this hour. Larry Tye is our guest. Larry is the author of Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon, and he's, as you heard him say, writing a book right now about Senator Joseph McCarthy. The two are linked, Bobby Kennedy and Joe McCarthy, and of course the Kennedy family linked his father, particularly with Joe McCarthy. Larry's going through all kinds of private papers that have just been made public, and is meeting people in Appleton and various parts of the state to get a sense of who Joe McCarthy was. Some of you may remember him. Some of you may have, well, everybody remembers him historically, certainly in this state, but some of you may have actual remembrance of his speaking to a group or his election. So we would welcome your phone calls. Larry would, I'm sure. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, where we always like to get your messages. And we are on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. Lines are open for you right now, and we are going to start phone calls, Larry, with Ruth in Altoona. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. Very interesting program. Thank you. I have a comment that is for this particular hour as well as last hour. I don't know why we aren't bringing in more conversation about Bernie Sanders and the support that was behind Bernie's ability to speak to a wide range of people and garner an enormous amount of support with not anywhere near the attention from the Democrats that Hillary was getting or from the media that Trump was getting. And I think he brought a message that really resonated across this country with working class people as well as, you know, across generations, across economic levels. And I personally know people who voted for Trump who otherwise would have voted for Bernie. And they have told me that because they wanted something different. And to them, Bernie was that. Bernie Sanders' message spoke to them. And so as we have this conversation about what's happened to the Democrats or what's the future, I feel like the conversation is not a full conversation unless we include that.
Thank you, Ruth, for your call. Larry.
Sure. So I half agree with Ruth. I agree with her that Bernie Sanders' message was resonant. I think he's from my neighboring state of Vermont. He is an eloquent speaker, and he speaks to a lot of the same concerns that Donald Trump was addressing in terms of a very populist message. Where Bobby Kennedy would have had a problem with Bernie Sanders is Bobby Kennedy couldn't stomach ineffective liberals. And he would say, geez, Bernie Sanders was in the Senate for all this time, and while he's been there as a clarion voice since he has run for president, he got nothing done in the Senate. And I think that you could argue why he got nothing done was that he was maybe pushing for things that ought to have happened and nobody would support him. But Bobby Kennedy couldn't tolerate liberals who couldn't get the job done. And that was one of the extraordinary things about him. He was saying, we can combine pragmatism and idealism. And Bernie had half the message, and I think Hillary Clinton had the other half. So if you could have combined his eloquence with her pragmatism, I think the Democrats would be in the White House today.
Mm. And do you think he would have won, Bobby would have won?
So my theory, and nobody can prove me wrong, is that I think he would have won overwhelmingly. Mm. The ticket would have been, I'm convinced, because this is what happened. Let me tell you, the day after Bobby was killed, your listeners who are old enough will remember that he was murdered the night of his greatest political victory in the California primary. That next morning, he was due to go to Chicago to meet with Mayor Richard Daley, the most powerful big city mayor in America. Daley's son, 50 years later, says that there was an 80% chance that the mayor was going to endorse him for president. The most powerful establishment Democrat endorsing Bobby in the wake of having won California, with Hubert Humphrey, his main competitor, not having entered any of the primaries, I think the ticket would have been likely a Bobby Kennedy, Hubert Humphrey ticket, maybe Hubert Humphrey and Bobby Kennedy, but Democrats and Republicans in those days united to form this strongest ticket, which is how Jack Kennedy ended up with a guy he couldn't tolerate named Lyndon Johnson. Had Bobby Kennedy been the candidate in 1968 against Richard Nixon, there was nobody in America who better understood Richard Nixon's vulnerabilities from having run his brother's successful campaign against Nixon 8 years before. Bobby couldn't wait for a rematch against Nixon, and Nixon was most afraid of all his potential opponents, as he wrote in his memoir. He thought it was going to be Bobby, and he was worried about Bobby.
Hmm. Larry Tai is our guest. His book, and he'll be speaking about it tonight at the Pyle Center on the UW campus in Madison from 6:30 until 8 p.m. It should be a great conversation. If you'd like to meet him in person and talk more about all of this, you're invited to do so. Also invited to join our conversation, a call to those of you who may have followed Senator Joseph McCarthy many years ago closely here in the state of Wisconsin or have stories about him. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to participate here on the Ideas Network. Larry Tai is our guest. His book, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. He's been on our show before talking about this great book, and he's now writing a book, and he's in Wisconsin writing about Senator Joe McCarthy. Let's go to phone calls. Dan in northern Wisconsin. Hey, Dan.
Hello, how are you today?
Fine, how are you?
All right.
Good.
I was just wondering how far you're going back in Joe McCarthy's history. You're going back to the days when he drove his motorcycle around Shawano County and Waupaca and Manawa and the whole area in Clintonville.
So the answer is I'm going back. I'm going to mainly focus on his public career. But as part of that, I'm going to try to weave in the story of everywhere that you mentioned. What I'm not going to try to do is pronounce with a Wisconsin appropriate accent any of the places that you name.
What do you know about what was going on, Dan?
Well, the thing was, is I knew that he was a very popular lawyer in the Shawano County area. And the other part was, is that he was close personal friends of my parents. As a matter of fact, he was the best man in their wedding.
Oh.
So we've heard Joe McCarthy stories my whole career. Well, my whole life. I was younger. I was born almost as right as time he was passing away. But my father always told stories about, you know, he believed that, you know, of course, a lot of the information, which maybe you're finding out in some of those other hearings, that there was a certain truth. But then things got twisted, and he believes that, I don't know if he was poisoned physically or mentally or, you know, socially with his drinking, but... There was definitely a change after he had gone to Washington.
Yeah, and Dan, how did he happen to become your parents' best man at the wedding?
Well, he and my dad were pretty good pals back in the day, and that's kind of where it went. You know, they liked to in that day and age in the early 30s, they had a lot of fun.
Right, go out drinking together is what I assume you're saying, Larry.
So. First of all, I would love to hear from Dan further off air about this because it sounds like he's got terrific stories, and those are the kinds of things I've come to Wisconsin to gather. I want to just say one thing. I was at the cemetery, St. Mary's Church Cemetery in Appleton, where McCarthy was buried this past weekend. And it's extraordinary if you go there. You don't have to be told which grave is McCarthy's. You don't have to look at the name on the gravestone. All the other graves are facing east-west. Joe McCarthy's is north-south, right on the banks of the river. So for the rest of his afterlife, he gets this extraordinary view of the Fox River, and he gets it sort of, it's like he is got his entire flock there. The rest of the cemetery looks like it's responding to him, and it's a really interesting setup. Nobody at the church today is quite sure how it happened, but Joe McCarthy managed to get one last interesting twist into his time on this earth.
Interesting. Did he request that?
So nobody knows that, and I can't imagine that he would have asked for anything sort of facing a different way, and yet anything that he had enough panache that I wouldn't be surprised if he had requested it. I wouldn't be surprised if the same people who year after year for nearly 50 years showed up every year to pay tribute on the day of his death, if those people had requested it, who knows who did it.
Right. But. Fascinating. Dan, can we put you on hold and get information for Larry?
Sure can.
Great. Thanks very much. All right, we'll work that out for you, Larry, and get information. Let's go to Jerry next in Reedsburg. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. How are you doing?
All right. How are you?
I'm terrific. I am. You bet. I grew up in a small town. Your previous caller just talked about it. It was Manawa, Wisconsin. That's where I went to high school. And Senator McCarthy finished 4 years of high school in 1 year. And I thought that was a pretty unique feature of one man doing that. But, yeah, that's one fact. But I have some friends that know a lot more about him than I do that live in the Manawa area.
All right. We're going to get everybody on hold and send you a lot of context, possibly. Do you know about that, Larry? He finished 4 years of high school in one?
I do. So I think it says a couple things about him that are interesting. One is that he had to be out there working. His family was very poor, and he had to be out there working and couldn't go to high school when he might normally have started. So that says something about sort of the circumstances he grew up in. The fact that he was smart enough to be able to not just finish, but I heard a great story yesterday about one of his later political opponents who visited that school and wanted to get a look at McCarthy's records. And the principal showed him the records. And he wanted to look at it because he thought the only way this guy could have finished 4 years in 1 year is by rushing through and not doing well. Well, he not only finished, he got great grades. So that said that the guy was smart. And the idea that he was ambitious enough that he knew if he took 4 years, he'd be behind the eight ball in his intended eventual runs for office, for circuit court judge, and then for senator. This was a guy who was on the move quickly and didn't have a whole lot of patience and had the intelligence to be able to do something like that and pull it off.
Interesting. Jerry, thanks for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Jerry Ann from South Milwaukee sends this email. Will you, Larry, include Greta Van Susteren in your book about McCarthy? Greta is a daughter of a judge and McCarthy's best friend, was McCarthy's goddaughter, and has vivid childhood memories.
Yes, so the last email that I sent before I came to the studio for this show today was to Greta, and her brother Dirk has been wonderful in helping steer me, and their father was Joe McCarthy's closest friend, Urban Van Susteren, and everywhere I've gone in Wisconsin, as soon as they tell me their McCarthy stories, everybody wants to tell me a Van Susteren story.
Oh, that's interesting. Tell me more about Cohn and McCarthy. How did the two of them meet each other, and how did Cohn become so influential?
So Cohn, like McCarthy, was really smart and really precocious, and he came in as a young lawyer having finished law school in like a year and having had a record of prosecuting communists, and he was totally appealing to McCarthy. He gave legs to all of McCarthy's sensibilities that this was the issue that was going to catapult him to some national position. If you trusted Bobby Kennedy's take on Roy Cohn, he was a precocious jerk who stood in Bobby's way of having the sway that Bobby wanted to have. You had two smart guys there from very different backgrounds, the Jewish, relatively poor Roy Cohn, and the Irish Catholic, very wealthy Bobby Kennedy. Clash from the beginning. Both were appealing to different parts of Joe McCarthy, and he could only pick one to run things. He picked Roy Cohn. That's why Bobby left. Had Bobby stayed on and not Roy Cohn, many people think that Joe McCarthy wouldn't have gone under the way he did.
Mm. For some reason, I was just imagining in my mind what it would be like to have Senator Bobby Kennedy investigating the whole Russian connection with the Donald Trump campaign, how extensive it may be, whether or not there is one. He would really take on that task, wouldn't he?
He lived for things like that.
Right.
That's exactly what he would have done.
Yeah. Let's go to Bob in Coon Valley next. Hi, Bob.
Hi. And I hope you can hear me okay. It's the pitter-patter of rain on my umbrella, walking in mid-February. But don't worry, there's nothing wrong with the climate. It's doing fine. This is normal. My question or comment has to do, I remember the time, and I was a supporter of Dean McCarthy. And it was a long time ago, and I don't remember all the details, but I remember how I felt at the time was that McCarthy had the guts to challenge the establishment in the same way that Bernie Sanders did more recently. And then Bobby Kennedy, you know, he's been accused of being an opportunist, and I guess I'm part of that camp. Bobby Kennedy saw that it was marketable to challenge the establishment, and he kind of got on board with it. So I didn't respect him all that much at the time. And so I'm just kind of making the comparison that I think with today's comparison, Bernie Sanders was Dean McCarthy, and Bobby Kennedy actually was, you know, the Hillary Clinton, who just is a little bit more of an opportunist. So I guess I'm just saying that I'm not that big a fan of Bobby Kennedy.
Great. Can I respond to that?
Of course you can.
So that is a story that the press played out in 1968, and that is understandable why anybody would believe that story. There was a wonderful line that that Lady Bird Johnson's press secretary said after Bobby Kennedy jumped into the race 4 days after the New Hampshire primary, 4 days after Gene McCarthy showed how vulnerable LBJ was. The press secretary said it took 20 years for Bobby Kennedy to come out against McCarthy, and he picked the wrong McCarthy. Now, that meaning Gene instead of Joe. Mm-hmm. The truth we learn 50 years later from interviewing lots of people who Bobby had talked to in the days leading up to the primary, is that 9 full days before that primary, Bobby Kennedy had made the decision to jump in and challenge Lyndon Johnson. He knew he didn't need Gene McCarthy to show him how vulnerable LBJ was, but he thought that McCarthy had been fighting so hard in cold, wintry New Hampshire alone against LBJ that McCarthy deserved an open shot before he got in. So he was ham-handed, but he was exactly the opposite of opportunistic or calculating.
Oh, that's fascinating. May change your opinion of the whole thing, Bob. Thanks very much for the call. Lou in Eau Claire, hi. Lou, are you there? Jake in Oshkosh, hi.
All right, hi, good afternoon. I was listening to the program that you were talked earlier about Bobby Kennedy and Hubert Humphrey getting together, and they would have been a shoo-in to be elected over Richard Nixon. Did you do any investigations in your research as to the assassination of Bobby Kennedy? I believe it was a political assassination, and I would like your thoughts on that subject, please.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. So I don't pretend to have any new information on the assassination of Bobby Kennedy. Lots of very smart people, including a congressman named Allard Lowenstein, raised very serious questions about the investigation, and I don't pretend to be able to come along and settle any of that. The sad thing is that the people who could answer those questions are dead, many of them for 50 years, and I don't think, but what I can say is that there was an irony in a horribly tragic Kennedy kind of irony in Bobby Kennedy's assassination. He had spent the earliest years of his political life, as has his brother Jack, outrunning rumors that the Kennedys were anti-Semites because Papa Joe, their father, was an anti-Semite. And he had to run away from those rumors as he was running for senator from the state in America with the largest Jewish population, which is New York. At the end of his life, he's killed by a Palestinian activist because he was too pro-Semitic. And the guy couldn't have it either way. He was either being accused of being an anti-Semite or his views on American Jewry and on Israel were anathema to a Palestinian, Sirhan Sirhan, who gunned him down.
Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget, and we've played this many times, it just makes me cry every time I hear it because I know the outcome, that he was going to die shortly after he went to Indianapolis to calm the crowd who just, he was giving them notice that Martin Luther King had been assassinated. Tell us that story. It's just remarkable, and what he said and how he said it extemporaneously and the way he said it and putting his family history, it's so sorrowful, but it's just beautiful in a way.
Sure. So to set the scene, this is in the middle of the first primary that Bobby was contesting in the state of Indiana, and he flies in one day in his private plane to Indianapolis for a big rally that night. And when he arrives, he's told that Martin Luther King has just been shot and killed. And the senator from Indiana, who only retired recently, he was the mayor of Indianapolis at the time, a guy named Richard Lugar, tells Bobby, "You have a rally planned for tonight in the middle of the African-American community, and you will not go there. You won't go there because you might not come out alive, and if you go there, you will cause a riot." Bobby listens politely, the same way he did when his brother Jack told him to stay out of the funeral, stay away from McCarthy's funeral in 57, and he does just the opposite. He gets in his car, he goes into the middle of the black community, he jumps up on the back of a flatbed truck, and he delivers what I think is easily and without hyperbole the most eloquent five-minute talk that a white politician has ever delivered in black America. He, for the first time in his life, talks about what it felt like losing his brother 5 years before. He can't say the name Jack. He can only refer to his brother as "someone in my family was shot and killed." Mm. He pleads for people, instead of getting angry, to come together and realize that we're all part of the same country, and the solution is not more hate, it is love. The evidence on what he did that night, you don't have to trust me. You should never trust an old journalist in anything they tell you. Don't trust me. Look at the evidence. There were only a couple cities in all of America that night with substantial African-American communities that did not have race riots. And the most notable one was Indianapolis, and the reason was Bobby Kennedy. For the rest of his life, any time he turned up in a black community for a rally, there was a sign somewhere in that crowd, a very modest sign, that said, "White, but all right." Now, that may not sound like much, but in 1968, with the racial tensions that were in America, he's the only politician, the only white politician, that blacks embraced in that way.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. People should listen to that address if you haven't heard it before. It's worth listening to. Larry Tai is our guest this hour. His book that he's already written is Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. He is currently writing a book and is spending time in Wisconsin gathering stories about Senator Joseph McCarthy. Of course, the two of them were linked. Senator McCarthy was Bobby Kennedy's first boss. Larry is a former Boston Globe reporter. He covered the Kennedy family for a number of years. He's speaking tonight. It should be a very interesting evening. It's from 6:30 until 8 o'clock at the Pyle Center at UW-Madison, and you are invited to be there if you're in the area. Well, we'll take more phone calls momentarily. Here's the number again, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We love to get your messages there. And we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network. And we go back to phone calls. Lou in Eau Claire has found us once again. Hi, Lou.
Hi, Kathleen. I found you mainly because I've tapped into my smartphone again. For some reason, my smartphone decided to shut you off exactly when you said Lou from Eau Claire.
I'm sorry.
Now, I don't know. Well, I have no idea why that happened.
I don't either.
Be a spiritual thing. It could be the divine presence saying, don't dare talk to Kathleen and Larry. But I want to tell you who I am. First of all, I'm Lou Frey, 78 years old. I'm a retired internist and geriatrician. I have followed the McCarthy and Kennedy lives for all those years. And Joe McCarthy was, as I watched him as a young person, I thought he was crazy and really dangerous. You have changed my mind today, and I think that's remarkable. I'm going to buy the book and really read more. It is very clear to me that if failure to learn from history dooms you to repeat it, and we've all heard that. Now, what I really call to say, and it was only one thing, with all the Kennedys that you mentioned for potential presidential candidates, I did not hear the name Caroline. And I want to pursue that because Caroline, first of all, is a woman. Secondly, she's very articulate. Thirdly, she's just been the ambassador to Japan, which is one of our huge allies. She's been interviewed multiple times on Wisconsin public TV. And I am impressed with this person as a person. And secondly, as a woman, I think she has the potential to break that glass ceiling. Finally, I want to mention Hillary Clinton's book, It Takes a Village to Raise a Child, because one chapter in there, Hillary talks about what it was like to have her little baby, and she was wanting to breastfeed, and she, the first day of breastfeeding, she failed because apparently she thought the baby couldn't suck enough. When the nurse came in to help her out, it turned out that she had the baby upside down on her breast, and I thought that was such a funny story, and one that very few Hillary people would know because they haven't read the book. It Takes a Village to Raise a Child. So.
All right. Thanks, Lou, very much. I'm glad you got through. Larry.
So Lou was worth waiting for. I love his suggestion of Caroline. The only issue is that she thought about running for senator from New York and declined. I think she doesn't want to run for public office, and she liked the appointive office and being far away in Tokyo where she didn't have to deal with reporters every 5 minutes, but I'd love to see her run for office. The one in the Kennedy clan of that generation, if you want to break the glass ceiling, the one who I thought was going to do it was Kathleen Kennedy, mm-hmm. Bobby and Ethel's eldest, who was lieutenant governor of Maryland, looked like she was going to become governor, lost a campaign she should have won, and I think still aches someday to get back into it. And there's one more name that will be familiar to all your listeners, and that's Ted Kennedy Jr. He could have had his father's seat when his father died. It was his for the asking, and he said, I haven't earned it. So he moved from Massachusetts to next door to Connecticut, ran for the lowly office of state senator, and now I think is poised to run for the first statewide office that opens. So even that next generation has lots of people. The one after it has even more. And I think the Kennedy, America's love affair with the Kennedys, isn't over. And yet I'm from Massachusetts, so again, don't trust me. But the
thank you, Lou, so much for your call. Elaine in Colfax, hi.
Hi. I read a biography about McCarthy a while back, and one of the things I remembered about his intelligence that he had the ability to memorize what he read and repeat it, but he really had no ability to cross-reference. So it was very limited. It was almost like a trick. And I think that he was detached from his own viciousness as he got more and more famous. People said they thought it was cynical. He would say something publicly at a McCarthy hearing that was just devastating to an individual and then slap him on the back later as if he was an old friend. And I think that Trump may have that same characteristic of bullying people publicly and then privately seeming to be charming because he really seems to be disconnected from what he's doing publicly.
Larry.
Yes. So I think those parallels are really striking. I think that McCarthy's ability to separate almost as if it was a game, that we're all in there in the arena and I may attack you publicly, but we can be friends afterwards. That was a certain notion of what politics was all about. And it might have worked and it might have been okay, and lots of politicians do it, if his victims hadn't suffered so much. And I think that lots of people, a lot of his fellow senators in the most collegial body in the world, his fellow senators, even the ones who were on his side politically, generally couldn't abide by the viciousness of his attacks.
Hmm. Thank you, Elaine, for the call. Judy in Oshkosh, hi. Hello, Judy, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, okay then. Go right ahead.
My mother, Dorothy, went to high school in Manawa, Wisconsin, with Senator Joseph McCarthy. And she was about 4 or 5 years younger than Joe, and so she remembers well when he came there and went through school in 1 year and what good grades he got. He helped her with her algebra. And then later on, they never kept contact, although they both did end up going to Marquette University. And I am from Wapaka, and as I said, my mother went to school in Manawa with him, and I also had a kindergarten teacher that was one of his classmates. So she said that, my mother said that she thought his drinking was the cause of his problems later, but she would never say anything bad about him because she was remembering his hard work and intelligence and all the things he was as a young man.
So all I can say is I'd love to talk to Judy, and if she's still around, not just her mother, but her kindergarten teacher.
I don't believe either Melda Mortensen or my mother, Dorothy Miller, I know isn't still around, but I don't think that Mrs. Mortensen is either. But I read a book about Mr. McCarthy that had someone had interviewed him, or interviewed the Mrs. Mortensen in Wapaka.
Great. So, Judy, if you're game to let me get in touch with you, I'd love to do that.
Judy's game. We'll put you on hold, Judy. Lisa, we'll get your contact information. I want to make a comparison of decades here. You wrote, what Bobby Kennedy accomplished in 68 could be a beacon for today. America as divided then as it is today, as tempted by divisive bullies. Race riots, we have to remember, were igniting the cities. Overseas tensions were widening the split between parents and children. There was no national political consensus anymore. Is there a direct comparison, 1968-2017?
Yes, not even a stretched comparison, an easy comparison, sadly an easy comparison. And I have to say, and this is self-serving, I think one of the reasons we're revisiting so many of those same divisions today as we did 50 years ago is because Bobby Kennedy wasn't around. He would have been part of a healing process, and Richard Nixon on those kinds of issues was exacerbating many of the divisions and playing off of them. And I like to think, had Bobby been around and been the two-term effective president that I think he might have been, we might not have these same issues today.
Oh, what a hard decade that was, the 60s. Oh, man. So what are you talking about tonight, Larry?
So talking about Bobby Kennedy and the beacon that he offers, not just that he did in 1968, but that he could today, and talking about Joe McCarthy.
Mm-hmm. We have time for one more phone call, maybe. Let's go to Phil in Neshota next. Hi, Phil. Phil, are you there? Phil, don't waste your moment. All right, let's go to Karen in Milwaukee. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Kathleen. I love the show. When I was a youngster, I'm 76 now, so I was a youngster when the McCarthy hearings were going on. And it was the one thing that made me interested in politics. I would run home from school in order to see the remainders of the TV broadcasting.
Mm.
I don't find him to be redeeming. There was a communist around every corner. And as today, there's a terrorist around every corner. So I do think there is that kind of comparison, this rule by fear. I didn't find him to be very redeeming, nor Cohen. Cohen, I thought, was absolutely vicious and without any ethics.
Mm.
So, Karen, most of America agreed with you, and that's what brought down Joe McCarthy. Dwight Eisenhower had been waiting for McCarthy to stumble before he took him on. And when he took on, when McCarthy took on the army in the hearings that you would run home from school to watch, that's when McCarthy did himself in, rightfully, I think, at that point.
Thank you so much, Karen, for your call. Well, Larry, thanks again for joining us. I hope you have a great time tonight. When's the McCarthy book coming out? Do you know?
Hopefully before the next election. And whenever you're going to have me back on the show, I'll have it out.
What if we want you on the show before then?
All right. Then I'll have to rush and get it out faster.
Thanks, Larry, so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, Larry Tye, the book that he has written, and it's a good one, is Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Larry was a reporter for the Boston Globe for many years, covered the Kennedy family. Tonight he will be at the Pyle Center, UW-Madison campus, from 6:30 until 8 o'clock. Lots to talk about McCarthy, Kennedy, the 60s. The list goes on. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this program and Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production.